Hello, this is Guardian Daily on Tuesday, September the 29th, and I'm Michael White in Brighton on the day that Gordon Brown has to come up with the speech of his life yet again.
He should be bold, confident, and tell us what a Labour government will do.
And I'm John Dennis here at the Guardian's HQ in London. In other news today, how the city of Adelaide is on the verge of running out of water.
Yes, it possibly is global warming. It's also that we're in a particularly bad drought period. It's partly El Niño, but more than anything, it is overuse.
And you'll hear England rugby hero Johnny Wilkinson tell us about his Buddhist faith.
I was kind of still, ironically, a little bit bothered about what people thought about it. I'm aware, you know, there seems to be this kind of faddish kind of feel about people diving into these things.
But first, here's Bill Overton with today's news and a look at the papers.
240 people have died in the sudden flooding in the Philippines that swept through the islands, including the capital Manila, at the weekend. More than 370,000 people are living in makeshift shelters. The president's opened up her official residence to the homeless. There are calls for international aid as supplies run out. More storms are expected at the end of the week. Drought in East Africa, the worst in 10 years, means millions are now facing starvation. The Red Cross has launched an appeal to provide emergency aid to Kenya, where both wildlife and farm animals are dying, leaving farming communities without food. Oxfam, in turn, is launching an appeal for the whole of the region, from Ethiopia to Tanzania. The aid agency believes 23 million people are in danger. The Independent Police Complaints Commission is to investigate the suicide of Fiona Pilkington and her disabled daughter after years of harassment. An inquest jury said Leicestershire Police and two councils were partly to blame because they didn't respond to the mother's pleas for help. The police made a full apology last night. An inquiry has been launched into the cervical cancer vaccine Cervix after a 14-year-old girl in Coventry died within hours of receiving the drug. She suffered what authorities say was a rare but extreme reaction after being vaccinated at school as part of a nationwide immunisation programme. The NHS says it can't be sure of the cause until after a post-mortem. Meanwhile, the first children in Britain have started being treated with anti-swine flu vaccine. Two pilot studies involving 1,000 children under 12 have begun to test two different drugs. The story of the girl who died after a cervical cancer jab gets onto a couple of front pages this morning. The Times says schools are on alert and that her classmates at the Blue Coat School in Coventry have been sent home. The paper reports more than 14 million doses of the vaccine have been given since this vaccination programme began. But the inquest into the death of Fiona Pilkington is the dominating issue. Our paper headlines, "Police errors contributed to the tormented mother's suicide." The Telegraph says police let yobs drive family to suicide. The Mail, they're dead because no one cared. It tells us the mother made 33 calls to police over 7 years, but her calls were dismissed. The Sun carries the photo of a teenager in a hoodie on his bicycle, calling him a street rat because police allowed this teen and his gang to torment a mum and her disabled daughter to death. And three papers look forward to Gordon Brown's speech to his party conference today, all agreeing, as the FT puts it, that he's to challenge the Tories over crime. The Telegraph reckons the Prime Minister will give local councils powers to restrict pubs and clubs opening 24 hours a day. Our paper has been told the PM will promise a crackdown on bad parents because polls have shown the public want stronger action on antisocial behaviour. Our political editor sums it up as an attempt to woo Middle Britain. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
This is Michael White outside the main hall in the Brighton Centre, where later today Gordon Brown will lay out the case for a fourth Labour term in government. It's going to require a big change of fortune, but anything is possible, as the Prince of Darkness, Peter Mandelson himself, said yesterday.
We are in the fight of our lives, and yes, we do start that fight as underdogs. But conference, let me say this. If I can come back, we can come back.
Well, that's made it a great deal harder for Brown this afternoon because Mandelson raised the bar brilliantly, the best speech I've heard in the Labour conference for a very long time. But the Prime Minister will take the stage this afternoon and we understand he'll announce plans to crack down harder on antisocial behaviour, which has been a bit neglected since that man whose name we don't mention, Tony Blair, left office. I'm joined by The Guardian's political commentator, Martin Kettle. Martin, you've been critical of Brown for some time now. Is there anything he can do to win over you and, more important, doubtful voters?
He's got to make a speech which, at the end of which, people say, gosh, he's really good. They still have to think well of him. It's about convincing his party that he is the man. It's about scotching all the rumours and writing that people like me do about whether he's going to remain in office until the general election. And it's really about exerting his authority and being listened to.
But of course his new best friend Peter Mandelson has made this task harder. Yesterday afternoon he made a brilliant speech, never seen it quite like it from Mandelson, and never seen the hall respond as they did so warmly to the old Prince of Darkness.
Let me say, after these years away, it's good to be back home. When the Prime Minister asked me to return to the Cabinet last October, I felt a lot of things. Shock. I think I was as shocked as some as you. Surprise. My network of informants had let me down on this one.
He has done everything he possibly can, Peter Mandelson, to try to make Gordon Brown feel secure, actually. I mean, the support that he gave him in his speech was, I think, even by Mandelson's standards, gold-plated.
All right, in terms of the public, what's Brown got to? He's got to have a few ideas, a few policies to show his wheels aren't spinning in the mud. Is policy more important than the sense that, look, I'm in charge, I can do it, and the other lot will only mess us up and put us back into recession? That's what Mandelson was saying yesterday.
Well, I'm sure that Brown's speech will be completely in line with what Mandelson and Alistair Darling were saying on Monday, because in the end they have decided that they're going to run against the bankers, and I think that is the main rhetorical pitch that he's going to make. He's going to make a speech based on the bankers have been unfair, and the banking system has been unfair, and you know, it's an odd thing that he's only decided to do this in at this level now, but
it's reluctant. Heavens above, he allowed the bankers to do it. They did it on his watch. They did it, but he was the policeman on duty who was, you know, busy polishing his shoes or turning the other way.
Yes, but I don't think he's the person who's making the big calls now. I think it's much more of a joint strategy with Mandelson and to some extent Darling. I think these are powerful people around him now and they're setting an agenda, and I think they want the two things to be, first, a kind of real sense of indignation about the bankers because they think the Tories can't do that, and secondly, they've got to say and will say that the Tories can't deal with this crisis fairly.
Well, that's an interesting point, because part of Mandelson's speech seemed to be, and he did it very well because it's his style, was mocking the pretensions and ambitions of David Cameron and George Osborne.
We in this hall know what it took to make the changes that we undertook. Show me what has really changed. What's really changed in the Conservative Party? The truth is that the old Tory right that was rejected in 1997 are quietly feeling at home again in David Cameron's Tory Party.
I had a thought which came as a surprise to me watching Mandelson in the post-Brown era. Let's assume Labour loses the election, there's a new leader, and they're scrabbling around with what I will rudely characterise as the teenagers, all of them, the Ballses and the Miliband brothers and all the rest, like, for the next generation. They've but they're very unformed politicians. And I thought, what are they wasting their time for? I've never thought this, let alone said it, wasting their time when they've got Mandelson, who's a, you know, love him or hate him, he's a player and he's a grown-up, and he struts the stage.
And he's very good at working things out. I mean, he's worked out what would work at this conference. I think, you know, what's striking is he has tried to say, you know, that all of this that he's been promoting about the economy fits into the New Labour story, into the New Labour narrative. He's just done it with considerable style, as you would expect.
Martin Kettle. Well, what did Labour delegates here make of Mandelson's spectacular return to form?
I thought it was fantastic, electrifying, clear. I thought it was wonderful, wonderful speech. One of the best speeches I've heard for a while, actually.
What's changed, Mandelson or the party, or a bit of both?
I think it's probably a bit of both. The environment we're operating in as well has changed, and I think, like I say, with the focus of what we've got against us, I think all those things are just binding us together, and he's showing true leadership. And like I say, well, you heard it in there. I mean, the people love him. The delegates love him.
That's really good, yeah, really inspiring, definitely.
Have you ever heard Mandelson do a turn before? Because you're so young.
No.
Were you surprised?
No, not at all. Not at all.
You weren't surprised. You're meant to be surprised.
No, no.
Well, wasn't he meant to be a surprise?
I don't know if it was meant to be a surprise, but certainly I thought it was very inspiring. It made us, gave us a real call to arms, really, to go out and fight the next election.
Well, it was a tour de force and very entertaining, I thought. Where he specifically made pledges, it was very good to hear them and to hear firm policies. And the audience obviously liked it very much indeed.
Have you heard Peter Mandelson speak before?
Oh, yes.
It got an unusually warm reception from a Labour Party conference for Peter Mandelson.
I think that it's not about Peter Mandelson. I think this move to policies of the left in the Labour Party is being very well received by the audience in there.
Among the media people milling around, there's Jeremy Paxman. You've seen Mandelson speak many times. Have you seen Mandelson give such a polished performance and get such a reception?
I think it was certainly the best speech I've ever heard Mandelson give, and I would say so far the best speech of the conference.
So would I.
The only one to touch them, I thought. I mean, it was funny. It was also, I thought, very oddly like a sort of elder statesman. Didn't you think? I mean, there was something that just...
He's much more comfortable with himself these days.
Ah, yes.
Extraordinary. Yes. Extraordinary. Well, we've lived to see it all. The Labour conference cheering Peter Mandelson.
I know, unprecedented, really.
Excuse me, you were on the platform before lunch, weren't you?
I introduced Alistair Darling's speech.
I knew I'd seen your face. I knew I'd seen you on the big screen. We're asking people, delegates, what they thought of Peter Mandelson's speech. We're from The Guardian.
It was amazing. He was really inspiring and really sort of upbeat, lifted up our hopes. He's such a great speaker, such a great politician.
You hadn't seen him speak before, presumably. What with you being 16 or are you 17?
I'm 17.
17, there you are. And you're in the sixth form in, where was it again, you said?
Rushcliffe in Nottinghamshire.
So that's from Ken Clark country, yes. Yes, well, of course, Mr. Mandelson and Ken Clark agree about quite a lot of things. It's David Cameron he was picking his fight with today. Anyway, you were impressed.
Yes, I thought he was brilliant.
Thank you very much.
So what can we expect from Brown today? Past conference speeches have brought us phrases such as hard-working families and, less successfully, British jobs for British workers. He's going to need more than soundbites today. As the conference builds up towards this afternoon speech, we ask people arriving at the conference centre what they want to hear from the Prime Minister.
I think he needs to perhaps give things a bit of a wider scope. I think perhaps we've sort of been a bit focused on some of the old Labour stuff, and it'd be quite interesting to see a bit of new vision, a bit of new thinking ahead of the next election.
You mean the domestic agenda, the economy and the health service, or do you mean the world economically, or wider issues of peace and war and hunger and the environment and all these things which press down on us?
I think I'd almost start off with the biggest, widest possible picture, which is kind of where is Britain's place in the world and its relationship in terms of defence and Europe and all of those issues. And almost because of the economy and because of spending, everything else almost filters down from that. So, you know, what are Labour's priorities and what's a realistic context in which to kind of set those priorities out?
Linda Reardon, MP for Halifax. Being a great fan and thinking, believing that he is the man to lead us into a next general election, he should be bold, confident and tell us what a Labour government will do, as opposed to a Tory government that will destroy what we've created over the last 5 years.
He seems to have difficulty getting this message across.
Well, that's Gordon, as we know him, and I'm very proud of him, but that's the man is a genuine believer in a socialist party, so let's get behind him as MPs and support him.
Well, there was a time when a speech by Gordon Brown was interpreted primarily for what he was trying to say about Tony Blair, whom he spent a decade trying to get rid of, with results which have proved disappointing to his most ardent supporters. He used to talk about real Labour, we're best when we're real Labour. Oh, we all knew what that meant. Anyway, he's on his own now, and Blair's great henchman Peter Mandelson gave him more support on more generous terms
than their past history justified yesterday, but he also made it harder for Brown to be the star of the show, and I'm still laughing. A Labour conference cheering Peter Mandelson with gratitude. Beat that if you can, Gordon.
Michael White in Brighton, and there's full coverage of the Labour conference today at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website, how love letters from the Second World War were reunited with a relative of one of the authors, guardian.co.uk/G2. Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall's Perfect Packed Lunches, an extract from the new River Cottage book, is at guardian.co.uk/food. And an exhibition at London's White Cube Gallery of work by the Chinese artist Zhang Huan features two live pigs. And we've got a pig farmer to review the show at guardian.co.uk/arts. I'm John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, the hidden sounds of the city of Leeds. But first, in southern Australia, the city of Adelaide is on the verge of running out of water. It could be a matter of months before the city's 1.2 million people rely on bottled water, as our correspondent in Sydney, Tony O'Loughlin, explains.
Well, in Adelaide at the moment, they've actually just had some rain and the dams are now topped up. But the dams only have enough water for another year, and water is really at critical levels in Adelaide and indeed in South Australia. South Australia lies at the southern end of the Murray-Darling River system, which is some 2,700 kilometres long. And before the water gets to them, there's all these rice growers and cotton growers sucking the system dry so that the poor old people of Adelaide and South Australia are kind of left with barely a trickle.
How many people could become reliant on bottled water?
Well, by next week, there could be about 30,000 people in some 11 townships, rural townships, east of Adelaide. If salinity levels were to become so serious to threaten Adelaide, well, you're talking about something like 1.3 million people. But it's not quite that bad yet for Adelaide, though water authorities are warning that Adelaide only has another year of drinking water left.
I mean, this would cost a fortune to supply that number of people with bottled water.
Yes, it is. Unfortunately, I don't know how much it would cost, because it's a bit like asking how long is a piece of string. The town's mayors do not know how long this situation could go on for. You know, they're kind of expecting maybe next week the emergency procedures will kick in. But after that, who knows how long it will last for. It could go on for days, it could go on for weeks or months.
And do people have faith in the authorities to take the measures necessary to keep people supplied with water?
I don't think so. The mayor talked about a rising levels of anger in the town. Now, for years, decades in fact, this has been coming, and people have known about the river being overused, but governments have been extremely slow to act. So in the meantime, people have lived with a bit of a schizophrenic attitude to the river. On the one hand, you have people thinking, well, while ever there are flows in there, I will just take what I consider to be mine. At the same time, knowing the river was falling into deeper and deeper trouble. So now, you know, you have people who really are living with the prospect of not having drinkable water in their house, and people are starting to become quite angry.
Tony O'Loughlin.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Traffic noises, mobile phones, dogs barking, we all know the familiar sounds of the city. But the German sound artist Christina Kubitsch has tried to highlight the acoustic phenomena that we wouldn't normally hear. Her work's been commissioned by Expo Leeds, a festival of sound art and experimental music. And The Guardian's Martin Wainwright donned his headphones and went on an electrical walk.
I'm in Leeds, the centre of Leeds, where for the last few days, the artist Christina Kubic has been organising electrical walks. They're the first in Britain. She's done them abroad, she's done them on the continent and in the United States. But what they are is, but this is electromagnetic sound, and it's a real eye-opener or ear-opener, the amount of noise that's going on in a city that we can't hear. Richard Whitelaw's going to take me around or start me off. Rich, can you just explain the purpose of this, or rather, what it actually involves? I shall find out for myself in a minute.
These rather large, clanky headphones that I'm holding at the moment allow the listener who's walking around the city to listen in, eavesdrop on this sort of secret sound world, essentially.
And do you, if you've done it for a while, can you tell, you know, that's a television, that's an iPod, that's something else?
Certainly, even just going around briefly, and some of the locations that Christina has given in the map of the walk, like for example in PC World, you can listen to different types of large display screens and hear the different sounds that they make, and some things are particularly loud.
This is our first thing. This is like an illustrated guide to the light shopping centre, and normally you'd hear nothing, but wearing these headphones which I've just put on and turned on, if you come near, and I'm about a foot away now, there's a really loud reverberating sound, and if you went any closer, it would actually be unpleasant. Oh, let's go in search of some more. You're going on an electromagnetic audio tour of a lead shop. Is it, we're in the changing room now. Now, that's quite some noise. This is in a little room where mannequins are stored, used for displaying clothes in the shop. One of the stops in the road we're in, Park Row in the centre of Leeds, is an HSBC cash machine. Quite interesting to hear what that sounds like. I'm getting a mixture of buzzing and humming as we go along. And a very loud one there. Would that be security?
Yeah, I think so.
I shouldn't say so, but burglars could use these. Okay, now this is the Olympic Leisure Slot Machine arcade at the city station, and you can hear this kind of conventional sound going on here as well. But if we travel along by the machines, I'll just put the earphones on in a minute and see if we get some different sounds. That's more of a kind of whine. That's coming from a machine called Mr. Moneybags, which has a sound all of its own. Ah, here's another one. The next door machine here, which is called Deal or No Deal. So you've got a completely different sound there, which is, in a kind of specialist sort of way, interesting. Ah, now that was amazing. That was a bus. And actually, if we catch it up, we might just be able to record the bus. Right. We're running for a bus, but not for the usual reasons. Well, that was a bus. That was a number 33 bus from Cookridge.
Martin Wainwright reporting. Well, now rugby and Johnny Wilkinson's recent return to form for Toulon has boosted England's hopes ahead of the autumn tests. Wilkinson told The Guardian's Donald McRae how his Buddhist faith helps him control his obsessive personality.
It's nothing more than for me than a philosophy and a way of life. I just seem to resonates with me.
Yeah,
I identify with it. I agree with so much of the sentiment behind it, and I enjoy the liberating effect it's had on me from being able to get back into the game as such in a way which is so much more rewarding because you're enjoying the actual moment of being on the field, as opposed to what I was doing, which was summing it up perfectly, was basically getting in the changing room, sitting down and wiping my brow and just saying, thank God that's over. I managed just to keep my head above water, and the expression I sort of, when I tried to, you know, I've written about it in a whole book on the basic thing, it was that it was about just surviving in a position, in a place where you are so privileged to have all these amazing experiences, and yet you spend them just keeping your head above water. And I think for me that was a point where I realised that I was coming towards the end of my possibly rugby career, my knee was bad and things were going on, and I realised that what if I had to say goodbye to that right now? Would I be pleased with how I lived it? And I think the only way I would have said yes was if I was one of those guys that carried around a portfolio of my best moments with me in my pocket, so whenever I met anyone I could say, here's my video, here's my favourite, and that's not interesting to me. Yeah. It was about just saying, did I make the most of that experience? Mm. Playing at Twickenham, playing at Marseille, playing in Toulon, did I really enjoy it? Did I help other people to try and get to their goals?
Johnny Wilkinson talking to Donald McRae. And you can hear a longer version of that interview in which Wilkinson talks about his rival Danny Cipriani at guardian.co.uk/audio. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Andy Duckworth, Tim Mabey, and in Brighton, Phil Maynard. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.